From the Pentagon Papers to WikiLeaks to Citizens United, renowned First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams has been on the forefront of scholarship and practice of First Amendment cases and is considered the preeminent expert on the subject. Remarkably, over his 50-year career, a comprehensive profile of Abrams and the First Amendment as it has evolved through the 20th and 21st centuries has never been done, whether on television or radio, online or in print. That has been taken care of with the publication of his new book, Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Floyd Abrams to the program. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
You have taught law at Columbia School of Journalism and Yale Law School, as well as Columbia Law School, and have taken on these issues, have taught about these issues, and have been very much a part of this debate. What is it about the subject of the First Amendment, do you think, that we struggle with as a people, as a society?
You know, I think the hardest thing about the First Amendment is what you might think of as the core, the center of it. The very notion of, you know, letting people say things that we not only disagree with, but we think are sort of awful. Awful because they would lead to bad policy, or awful because they're phrased in offensive ways or outrageous in one way or another. Long ago, Justice Holmes, no less, talked about the First Amendment meaning that we protect the speech that we hate. But that's really almost counterintuitive. I mean, it grates against our feeling that you know, if someone's wrong enough, it's terrible sometimes to hear the person out. And the central command of the First Amendment is that you don't have to listen, but you can't shut people up. We can't do it, and the government can't do it. And it's hard on a human level for people to live with it, unless and until they really sort of are willing to say to themselves, it's just worth the price.
So when you think of the issues that we encounter as a country and as a people, the First Amendment so often is brought into that. And I'm curious as to, for you in your career, what was it about that amendment? What was it about those issues that brought you into this and to become one of the experts and have that be your legal expertise?
I was always interested sort of academically, sort of a fun subject to write about, in college or whatever. But when I graduated from law school, and that was the around 1960, February 1960, and I started to practice law into the 60s. It really began in the mid-late 60s when there was such turmoil in the country and so much hostility and anger, and the war was on, and President Nixon was unpopular with a lot of people and was very angry at the press and the like. And I started to meet journalists who in part because the law firm that I went to and I'm still at represented NBC. And I started to meet journalists for the first time. And I really admired what they were doing. I really admired the role they were playing in American life. And I would say that for me, that was sort of a turning point, that here were these people, not selflessly, they also want to get ahead, but who I thought were really serving the public by doing their thing as well as they could.
Of course, a lot of this began with the Pentagon Papers and your high-profile client of the New York Times and representing them in the Pentagon Papers case. Do you learn a lot from a situation like that?
Yes, yes. And in a way, even more, because I was a pretty young lawyer then, when it's easier to learn more. You know, you learn things, intensely practical things, like how important it is, what the background is of the judge that you get. The judge we got, by pure chance, was someone who was hearing his first, literally, his first case, but who during World War II had been in military intelligence. And because he was in military intelligence, I think he had a self-confidence in looking at what the government was trying to suppress, at looking at the documents that the government was saying would really do terrible harm if they came out, and saying, you know, that there's just not that much there. It can't be that serious. So you learn things like that. And, of course, you learn in the sort of fire of combat that is watched around the world about participating in a case that is half case and sort of half circus. Circus, not because of any judge, but just because of the amount of public interest in it. It was a great learning experience for me.
Many compared the Pentagon Papers to the WikiLeaks case. You have a piece included in this book, which you wrote for the Wall Street Journal in 2010, on why WikiLeaks is unlike the Pentagon Papers. What is it about that? Because the issues are similar, but to you, very, very different.
Right. Yeah, some of the issues are similar. And WikiLeaks, indeed, has done some good. My comparison really wasn't so much a legal one as a journalistic one, and my own passing judgment on the behavior of the two entities involved. I was very impressed working on the Pentagon Papers case, for example, and I talk about this in my book, how at the very end the trial judge called us in and said, look, my ruling is that the Times can publish any of this material about how we got into the war. But now I want to speak as a private citizen. I really wish they wouldn't do such and such. There's some information there about a contingency plan, which I just don't think, you know, it's in the public interest to publish. You're allowed to. I'm talking as a public citizen, private citizen now. But, you know, I really wish you'd give the Times my views. And we did. And they had already decided, actually, not to publish some of it, and they did decide not to publish more, and they published some of it. I thought that was how the system ought to work, and I was and am very impressed by it. I compared that to WikiLeaks. I mean, my sense was that there's much more of a sense there of sort of anything goes, that if they have information, they go with it, that they revel in sort of not editing, not making decisions. But not making decisions, in my view, is making them. And so when WikiLeaks came upon, or their source gave them 90,000 American military reports from Afghanistan, written by American soldiers, and they literally handed out very quickly the 77,000 of them, initially withholding another 15,000. And some journalists said, have you guys read these 77,000? He said, well, we've read about 2,000. Mm. Well, how can you hand them out? The answer was, we don't think there's any particular national security harm in doing it. Well, you know, my view was, first of all, that's not journalism. That's political activism, which is also protected by the First Amendment to a very great degree. But it's not journalism, and in my view, it's not very admirable. I think it's reckless to just sort of hand out material because you've got it, even if you think, without reading it, that doing so won't do any harm. So in that sort of sense, in the sense of my own exercising my own First Amendment rights to pass a sort of judgment on WikiLeaks. I just thought that they were too often too reckless.
I thought about that when I was reading your segment about Judith Miller. You represented Judith Miller for the New York, a reporter for the New York Times. You represented her. Do you feel that, looking back on it, that there is the issue and there is the law, which of course is what you're going after, and also ultimately representing reporters and journalism as a whole, but there still is a balance, and we don't necessarily have to like what Judith Miller is doing or even like Judith Miller?
That's true. I mean, and again, I think we have to distinguish between what it is we think the law ought to protect and what personal judgments we make. I was very disappointed that an awful lot of people who I had thought cared about journalists being able to protect their sources did not support us in the Judith Miller case, because they were angry at her reporting and attributed to her some responsibility for the war in Iraq, even. And I thought that was wrong-headed thinking, at least if you're thinking with a First Amendment hat on. That said, just as I pass judgment, as you just heard, on WikiLeaks from a personal point of view, not passing judgment on how much legal protection they get, but just, you know, what do I think of them? You know, for people who thought that Judith Miller's journalism was wanting, you know, they ought to criticize her. But it shouldn't, in my judgment, it really shouldn't affect their view about whether she's entitled to full First Amendment protection and whether we should support her, what I consider rather valiant efforts to protect her confidential source.
You write in a piece in the book about on thinking about the First Amendment and the Internet, and I found it fascinating because when you think about technology, technology has changed wildly since that amendment was written. And I guess what's ultimately fascinating is no matter what technology you throw at it, it still holds up, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. Now, one thing I said I thought might result, and I still think is likely to result, from the enormity of the change in technology and the fact that, you know, we now have this gift of the Internet, which so many people can be on for, you know, essentially no money and have access to all this information and be able to speak out with no intermediaries blocking them, et cetera, et cetera. One legal consequence of that may be that the courts are going to start saying, look, we're not going to give the press any more protection than anyone else, because we don't know what the press is anymore, or to put it a different way, everybody's a publisher, fine. Everyone's a publisher, everyone gets the same amount of legal protection, but don't expect us then to start protecting your confidential sources, because, you know, we just can't live in a society in which anyone who promises confidentiality doesn't have to appear in front of a grand jury, say, to testify. That at least was my concern. It still remains a concern of mine. I wouldn't trade in the Internet because of that concern, but in direct answer to your question, the basic First Amendment, the core First Amendment principles remain the same, whatever the medium, however one communicates, however we find new and better and cheaper and more accessible ways to communicate, the First Amendment principles have got to remain the same.
Because even if we're talking about a newspaper and talking about something 100 years ago, that the New York Times would be treated differently than someone who is publishing a newspaper out of their basement that went to 50 people.
That's right. That's right. No, that, I mean, it's you know, some things are better and some things are worse. But again, the core level of protection has got to be the same.
The name of the book is Friend of the Court, On the Front Lines with the First Amendment. The book is published by Yale University Press. Floyd Abrams, a great pleasure to have you on the program. I thank you very much
for sharing. Thank you very much for letting me on.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Again, the title of the book is Friend of the Court. It's published by Yale. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.